just can't do this thing anymore. As we did the pre-show conversation, this everything from the couch stuff is just, it was okay at first, but it just gets weird. It feels, after a while, it just feels too bloggy. It's too bloggy after a while.
Yeah, no, like, I get it. I mean, I also live in Australia now, so like, I am all the way away from the world and staying literally on the opposite side of the world. So I'm going to be on my couch for a while, but like, I'm excited to see people back in the stands. It's like a different vibe in the arena.
Let's get into that. Let's get into that. Why are you in Australia? What happened?
My wife is from Melbourne originally, and we wanted to move. We've been like setting this up for, God, since December of last year, probably.
Wow.
So like, it has nothing to do with like coronavirus or anything. Like, we started taking our animals like on in January to get this stuff figured out. So
I assume kangaroos, duckbill platypus, these are the animals. This is just my assumption based on region. There was the Victoria lockdown. How did you guys get through the lockdown or wriggle through all that? That's what I'm curious about.
So we just got here a little over 3 weeks ago. The lockdown broke. We were locked down for a week, basically. Mm. Having said that, the whole thing of getting over here is pretty wild right now. I had to apply for a travel exemption that involved an awful lot of detail to prove that my wife, who is a citizen of Australia, obviously, and a dual citizen of the United States, why I was married to her in order to get in, because they've shut down the borders like to anyone unless they're an immediate family member or a citizen. So I had to do all of that. And then we had 3 flights canceled just because there are flight caps right now to get over here. So we had to like reshuffle and rejigger our plans like a bunch of times. And then we get here and we had to do a 2-week quarantine in a Sydney hotel room where we literally can't leave the hotel room. Like, we can't even so much as can't go out on the, you know, we didn't have a balcony. You can't go out in the hallway. They knock on your door and deliver food. Like, it's pretty real over here. That it's hot take when you take coronavirus seriously. Good things happen because I didn't see what the numbers were yesterday, but we just had 5 straight days over here of 0 cases in Victoria.
Yeah. Well, if you're on an island too, an island country, although it's a fairly big island, I would assume that you almost want to be extra cautious. Now that doesn't even make sense. Now I'm thinking about it. That makes no sense. It just feels claustrophobic to me to have a spreading disease and be on an island. That is what I was reacting to, but there's no scientific reason for what I said having any weight at all.
Well, I feel like it goes both ways, right? Like, it's almost easier to keep it out. And once you once you get it out, like, it's gone, or it can be gone if you implement the right strategies.
At least for a long time, New Zealand seemed to be free and clear as an island. But yeah.
Right. But if you get it, I feel like, look, like, the country is screwed in that case because it can
spread
real quick.
The walls are closing in.
Yeah, no joke.
So wait, are you going to live the rest of your life in Australia? Is that the idea?
That's our current plan. I mean, we're working on looking into houses and stuff. I mean, look, if someone offers either my wife or I like a very exciting job opportunity over in the United States, we'd have a conversation about it. But, you know, we've always, you know, we've been together now for over 6 years and married for over a year now.
Congratulations.
Within the first 3 months of our relationship 6 years ago, we had a conversation of like, hey, would you be willing to move to Australia? And the answer was yes then. So yeah, like we've always planned to be here. It's just whether or not, you know, we stick here the entire time or if we stick here, you know, off and on.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Stars hang with stars. Winners hang with winners.
Oh, Okay, welcome to the House of Strauss podcast. We are joined by Sam Vecini of The Athletic, draft super guru. And now, is this the height of your season? Is this the height of your season right now, Sam? Are you locked in? Are you locked the hell in?
I am straight up, like Jimmy Butler, locked in. There are going to be clutch points graphics of me holding a chain and a lock because I am so locked in right now. I could not be more locked in. I don't know if I can curse on this podcast.
Oh, you can.
Jimmy Butler, like Jimmy Butler, I am so fucking locked in right now.
It's there you go. Well, it feels real now. It felt a little abstract, all these conversations about when the NBA is coming back and is the CBA going to be a thing and maybe LeBron wants to return, who knows, in the springtime. I don't know. But now that they've agreed to terms, now that they have settled on what the cap is going to be, now that we know it's going to be December 22nd, the draft's right around the corner. And it's a real thing. It's game on. And I'm getting a little bit excited about it because it has been dangling out there for a while. And I don't know about you. I feel like I have developed draft opinions. I've had takes and I have contradicted the takes and I have contradicted the takes again just because there has been so much time to analyzing these picks that we have, ironically, so little information about.
So it's funny. I was talking to my friend Matt Penny, who guests on the Game Theory podcast somewhat regularly. And I texted him last night. I was like, I'm watching Mason Jones tape right now. And I think I'm just to the point where I fucking buy it. Like, I'm in, right? Like I'm definitely in. And he goes, dude, we're at the point right now where this draft is waterboarding and we're just talking ourselves into wild things all the time right now. And he's right. Like, I think that Matt's 100% right on that. Like, I'm sitting here watching Mason Jones tape at 10 o'clock at night in Australia and going, oh my God, like I really buy the narrative. Like he's a former chubby kid that came from an elite basketball family and stopped playing basketball until he was a senior in high school. And then like went to community college and now he averaged 22 a game in the SEC. Like he's on this crazy upward trajectory. I'm in, like I'm buying it. And then you watch the tape and it's like, okay, like I really like the tape. He does a lot of, I don't want to like compare him to Luka Doncic at all, but the thing that he does similarly stylistically is like Luka Doncic has these very fluid hips and this ability to change direction without having to change speed, right? Like it's a very weird functional thing while also being great at changing speeds when he wants to. Mason Jones kind of has that thing while also just being like zero explosiveness athlete. And it's just like, well, if this doesn't work, he can't defend anyone. And he's like an okay shooter and he doesn't really pass. So what is the downside here is like, he's a EuroLeague guy. So what am I doing? Why am I talking about him as if I'm like all the way in on this guy right now, based off of rewatching tape after having watched it 2 months ago and 7 months ago when he was playing.
Why, I didn't expect us to start here, but why did it take a while for him to really enter the conversation and to be focused on, given all the time we've had to discuss this draft?
You know, it's interesting. I think that I don't even know that like he's entering the conversation now. Like I think he's been on the maps for NBA teams for a while. Kind of from what I gather from interviews, like he's going in and saying like, hey, like I think I am going to be an all-star at some point. Like I genuinely believe that, and teams have questions when they hear that from someone who is relatively late on the scene in NBA draft circles, insofar as like we didn't really think of Mason Jones as a draft prospect before this season, right? Having said that, like the idea of popping up late and these guys being like, quote unquote, baseball calls them pop-up guys, right? Yeah. I think that it's in part something similar to what you said. I think that even some people in NBA scouting circles, like their teams had them take like parts of August off, right? They were just like, look, this is an interminable draft cycle. Take a couple of weeks, reboot, and then we'll come back to it, right? Because God, if you can imagine watching 8 hours of the same exact tape or 8 months of the same exact tape for the same guys, it gets annoying when there's no new content to peruse. So, and no one's taking like the combine really all that seriously. And, you know, these workouts obviously have limited value. So I think that teams even kind of slowed down their draft process for a while and then went forward, starting again in like mid-September when they thought, hey, this is getting back into it. We're getting real now. We have to start tightening up who we like and what our board looks like.
I mean, this draft is just so heavy on imagine, guys, as in they haven't done it. They haven't actually produced even at a clip you would want from the leagues that they are in, the lower level leagues, and you are imagining that they're going to do better, and maybe they will, but whether it's Denny Avdija, I hope I'm finally pronouncing that right. Is that correct? Can we get a pronunciation check on that one?
No, you got it. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, hell yeah. Hell yeah. Okay, so whether it's Denny Avdija or LaMelo, who is thought to be the most talented draft pick but didn't exactly score at the efficiency that you would want in Australia, let alone the NBA, that's not to say he's a bad pick or won't show that star quality at the upper level. It's that this draft has so many guys where you don't have a track record to depend on. You're projecting it forward. Maybe that's why you're seeing something from Mason Jones, just because, you know, I'll make this argument for Obi Toppin. We'll get into it later. Like, I have a basic structure that I want from this, but you know, somebody like Obi Toppin, at least he did it. I feel like that's just not said enough that he actually was the best offensive player in college basketball for whatever that's worth. That doesn't guarantee you anything, but something like that seems like it's a more rare quality than we are sometimes acknowledging when talking about all these picks.
Right. Like, I have Obi Toppin at number 8, I think, 7 or 8, something like that. And I have him there despite the fact that I think he has very little chance to defend in space. Right. And defending in space is, for me, arguably the most important thing that we can find defensively from any position now, almost including centers, unless you're James Wiseman and you have all of the tools and measurements and everything in the world to be a genuinely elite rim protector. Everyone else, I'm like, okay, I want you to be able to guard and pick and rolls. I want you to be able, if you're a guard, to get over screens and recover, or I want you to be able to be switchable depending on, you know, the best scheme that I think you're a fit in. I don't really see it from Obi Toppin, but Obi Toppin is a guy that, like, he is so good offensively. He right now is like way closer to what John Collins is in the NBA right now than what I think he's getting credit for. He, like, his ability to shoot is real. He's an unbelievable passer. He's an unbelievable athlete. He has great feel for how to play the game. He doesn't hijack possessions. Like, he doesn't need to dribble the ball around the perimeter and pound the ball into the deck, kind of like a, you know, a Rajon Rondo, or even I'm trying to think of like a big equivalent to that. But like, he doesn't need to do that stuff. He's just going to slot right into an offense and be an elite role guy from day one. And that has value, even if there are real defensive questions going forward.
Yeah, I'm higher on him than 8 because of that. And I observe and I agree with all of those vulnerabilities. And I do think if he was a guy where he was averaging 2 blocks a game instead of, I think, 1 block a game, I'd go number 1 pick. But he's not. It's just under what you would need. I don't totally know. I mean, the other weird thing with this draft is we don't even know how large these guys are in some instances. You know, is the top in wingspan 7'2", as I've read in some places, or is it something different than that? I mean, these are things I would like to know. I assume somebody knows it. Maybe you know it. I'm not sure. But
so I'll give you funny stories on that because I don't know it. I don't know Obi Toppin's, and I have been to events where he has been there before and gotten measured. Last summer, he was at Nike Basketball Academy, and I think he got measured at 6'9" with a 6'11" wingspan or something like that. Now we have people saying he's a 7'2" wingspan, and like, I guess I'm just like, okay, sure. He looks longer than like a +2 guy, right? So I get that. And then additionally, NBA teams also have very real concerns about the combine and the measurements that they even got from the combine, because I'll give you an example. So Yudoka Azubuike, at the 2018 combine, measured with a 9'4.5" standing reach, Right. Big guy, enormous guy, 7 foot, 7 foot seven wingspan. You would expect it to be in that range. At the 2020 NBA draft combine, he measured with a 9 foot one standing reach, which is like Precious Achiuwa range, right? Yeah. And then people start melting down about the fact that Udoka Azubuike had a 41 inch vertical leap. Well, it's because they measured the initial measurement wrong with the standing reach. And that's how you end up with a circumstance where he's leaping incredibly high. So, and you talk to agents, you talk to players about this, and they're just like, it's not that it was haphazard necessarily, because I think that the league absolutely tried to do its best. It's just that there wasn't really any sort of consistency across the board. Yeah, so teams don't even really know what to do with these numbers at the end of the day.
Yeah, standardization is impossible. I mean, I talked to the Warriors. They're measuring the guys they have at their workouts. And so I know that they've got accurate measurements of, I'm trying to even remember, Anthony Edwards, James Wiseman, Denny Avdija, and probably a few others. So that's going to be fine and well for top-tier drafting teams that can get these guys in and do it. But maybe some of the teams further down the list are just not going to get those opportunities and they're going to be completely in the dark as to these just multi-million dollar investments that these players represent.
I love that you just keep putting more emphasis on the last syllable and Avdija. Like by the end of it, it's going to be like, Avdija.
It's going to be Kevin Harlan's going to like that one if he does well at all. Denny Avdija.
But no, I totally agree with you. Like teams at the bottom and teams specifically with multiple picks, like think about Boston. Boston has 14, 26, 30, and I think 47. Only get 10 visits, just like the Warriors, or the Warriors have 3 picks, so they're a bad example, but just like the Miami Heat do, only having number 20. So it makes it even trickier for them. Those teams are at a disadvantage because they're looking at guys in different areas of the draft and trying to, you know, figure out who do we like, who do we not like.
Yeah, although that might offer some opportunity, because if it's scrambled, maybe some guys will slide down the list who shouldn't slide down the list. And I guess here's a question for you. Which guys have seen their stocks rise and fall after the point at which all the basketball stocked? Because this is an interesting one to me, is that there would even be a rise and a fall independent of basketball happening, right? Because it all stops, it all comes to a halt in March because of the pandemic. And then certain guys have risen and other guys have fallen. And I want to get into why that happened, because it's very curious to me. Which are those guys?
So let me kind of qualify that part first in terms of how that happens, right? So the way that logistically the scouting process tends to work, right, is lower level scouts, scouting directors, etc. They go on the road throughout the year. They see everyone, they get eyes on everyone, and they write reports and bring them back, right? Sometimes you'll get assistant GMs involved by the time January rolls around, especially if you're a bad team and you know you're going to have a super high level draft pick. Think about when the NBA trade deadline is, though. It's in February, you know, early February. In past years, it was in late February. Typically, like, general managers and number twos in charge of NBA teams, president of basketball operations, number twos, number threes, these guys are like pretty locked and loaded on their own rosters throughout the season, like the NBA season, that is. So they don't really get out to a ton of events except for specific pockets. They get out to the Thanksgiving events like the Maui Invitational, the Battle for Atlantis, etc. They also tend to get out and start to really do this stuff in earnest at the conference tournaments and the NCAA tournaments. And it's because those events are logistically really easy ways for high-level people to get eyes on a lot of prospects at once. Right. You can go to Indianapolis for the Big Ten tournament and you can see all 15 teams in the Big Ten. And then The next week, you can travel to the SEC tournament, get eyes on all 15 teams in the SEC. You can get eyes the next day on 8 of the teams in the ACC because that event sometimes is right down the road, right? So I think that the reason why people would rise is as we get more involvement from higher level executives in the process, you're going to see different opinions come into the mix. And additionally, we have the added wrinkle this year of coaches being more involved in the process early on. Because in March and April, when it seemed like this stoppage was interminable,
oh yeah,
what were these coaches doing? Like Steve Kerr was watching tape, right? So there are more voices involved this year than there typically would be. So that I think is why you see certain guys like rising and falling, even though there has been no new tape throughout the course of this process.
Well, which guys, I think LaMelo Ball certainly has risen since the break point. Maybe a couple spots. Although I feel like he's fallen a little bit since the draft order was sussed out, just because it didn't seem like the teams in the top two had an obvious want for him. We'll see what happens, but it seemed like he rose, and then just the way that the draft order shook out was not LaMelo favorable. Is that your take?
I would agree that it was not LaMelo favorable, like Chicago getting the pick, Detroit getting the pick. Those teams getting it would have been really beneficial for LaMelo. I don't know that we'd be having this conversation about who is going to go number one if one of those teams had gotten the first overall pick.
Yeah.
Having said that, I do think that LaMelo has been like pretty steadily, you know, the guys that like him really like him. Like, I really like him. I think he's an incredible talent. The guys that have questions continue to have questions, right? There are going to be some teams that frankly just don't want to deal with the situation that will come from a guy who is already a social media star, who already has a very disruptive father, who could become more disruptive over the course of his early career. There are just going to be teams that want nothing to do with that. And I think they're making a mistake personally, but it's just an accurate statement that there are teams that will think of him lower because of that.
Yeah.
The guy that most has risen throughout this is Patrick Williams. And the reason for that is something that I didn't even mention within the context of, you know, the little spiel I gave on logistically how this works. We also had the bubble pop up. And I think that NBA teams are looking for more players in this NBA draft. Like, typically we have the NCAA tournament that jacks up everyone's stock or makes everyone's stock plummet, right? Because it's the last thing that we see. It's a recency bias situation for a lot of prospects.
Yeah.
I think this year the bubble is the recency bias that NBA teams are working off of in a real way. And with someone like Patrick Williams, he's 6'8". He looks like he has fucking boulders on his shoulders, right? Like, this dude is going to be 240 pounds and retain athleticism like it's nothing, I think. And he's going to be able to be a hopefully switchable defender, although I have some questions about his lateral quickness. He's going to be able to certainly play the 3-4 and maybe even some small ball 5, depending on how big he gets.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, so obviously I see what other teams see in him. Do we have an explanation of why he was only getting 22 minutes a game in the ACC? Why not more playing time?
Sure. So that's just because Florida State does this. Florida State kind of spreads around the minutes, spreads around roles. It is not abnormal for Florida State guys to have fewer minutes than what you would expect from elite level prospects. Like Devin Vassell this year was a first team all ACC guy. He played 28 minutes a night, right? Like, that's not necessarily normal for a typical college basketball player. Like, Patrick Williams was, I think, third or fourth on their team in minutes this year. It was just a situation where they spread things around.
Well, that makes me feel better about Patrick Williams. Is that something that has stuck out? Because especially if I'm looking at it from a more Warriors-centric viewpoint, if they did trade down, I can't see them picking Williams that high. But maybe if they trade down, you think, okay, they need a contributor quick. Can you really cross that bridge from 22 minutes a game in the ACC to making an actual contribution on a contending team? That seems like too long a journey. But the idea is you're saying that they just tend to do that. That makes you feel a little bit better about it. Yeah, that is true overall. The other guy that seems to have seen his stock risen, the aforementioned Denny Avdija. What's the deal with that? How did that happen?
Well, Denny is one of the very few prospects that got to play after the stoppage because he got to go over to the Israeli league and play a little bit. The thing with Denny is that his roles this year were very, very different depending on the competition that Maccabi was playing in. In EuroLeague, guys like Scotty Wilbekin and like Othello Hunter, if I remember correctly, like those guys tended to have a bigger role. Tyler Dorsey as well. And Denny was more of like a rotational player who would occasionally start and would play real minutes and would play a real role, but wouldn't necessarily be the primary guy. In the Israeli league, he basically shared the primary role with Scotty Wilbekin. That is obviously something that helped him because it allowed teams to really see him in a very primary role. And there were, like, the spotlight was essentially on him because no one else was playing. So I don't really think that Denny changed my mind in terms of things. Like, the fact that he won the Israeli League Player of the Year this year is crazy to me. Like, Scotty Wilbekin was better than he was this year. I'm sorry. I guess that there are probably political reasons why you want to get the guy who's going to be a lottery pick.
He's a national folk hero already. So yeah.
Right. Right. So like, I get it, but nonetheless, I think that seeing him win these awards and seeing him play really well on a team that won the Israeli league, I think certainly helped his stock just because no one else was playing. Now, I don't think he really changed anything for me personally, because I've seen him a bunch and I still worry about the jump shot and I still worry about the defense, because while he's not a bad defender in Israel, I worry a little bit about, is he going to be able to consistently slide and consistently be able to cut off driving angles? But
yeah, when I watched him, a little less than coordinated on defense, some fouls that were gumpy, I might say. And that was a long time ago. I mean, this was mostly in his brief stints in the EuroLeague games. But yeah, I think that there is reason for concern there, is what I would say.
Yeah, and I don't think he's ever going to be a sieve defensively. Like, he works really hard. He's an incredibly mature kid. Like, he is all the professionalism stuff, I think, is going to stop him from being a bad defender. He makes smart rotations. He works really hard. Like, Maccabi would put him on the opposing team's best player sometimes, late in games to get stops. And he showcased a real competitiveness in those situations, but it's just different over there. Like, it's just much different because there's less space.
Am I misremembering that he got some crucial stop on Shane Larkin? Am I remembering that? Or is that it? I'm trying to remember. It's like a million years ago. I
believe that's right. Yeah, I believe that's right.
God, you know what's crazy? You know what's crazy, Sam, is that the last time I saw you in person, this draft was the talk of the town in December at the G League Showcase. That's the last time.
I've literally left the country and started a new life in the midst of this draft cycle.
11 months ago in Las Vegas at the G League Showcase, all the executives were talking about this particular draft that is finally upon us. It is hard to wrap your mind around. It's pretty insane. So we have the explanation for the rise of Denny. Right now I'm writing an article just on kind of the idea is that these guys are mystery men and we don't know a lot about these guys. And the guy people are most interested in Warrior's Land is Wiseman. What have we learned about Wiseman since he played his last college basketball game, which was, God knows, probably around when the G League showcase was, or even way before that? Cannot even remember off the top of my head. The only real competitive one was against Oregon. The other two teams didn't matter. We have really one sample game to go off when it comes to Wiseman. What have we learned since that point?
Yeah, not very much, to be honest. I mean, I've been told he looks phenomenal in runs in Miami.
I see. I follow David Alexander on Instagram. Yes, I've seen this. Yes.
Yeah. And like, I'll tell you, like, I've talked to players that like aren't repped by Excel that have been down there and been through there. And they're just like, yeah, this guy's a monster. Right. Like people who have no reason to pump up James Wiseman are telling me that like he looks really great. It is just like a total freak show center. Right. I will say that like all of Memphis's staff has told me like incredible kid, really, really smart kid and very, very coachable, wants to be great. You know, like all the right stuff. And he has had this reputation of being a very high level, high character, high maturity kid throughout the course of his career. So like there's nothing that we're really going to learn about James Wiseman in this process that we don't know already. If you've been like the first time I saw James Wiseman, I think was like 3 or 4 years ago. And most NBA scouts are somewhat similar in that regard. So it's not really that anything has changed. It's just that like, it's funny that the narrative for me in my mind has almost flipped.
Yeah.
Like early on, I was like, okay, we don't have much sample of Wiseman. This is going to be kind of a risky pick. I'm kind of at the point now where I think about it and think about the tools and think about the character. And I'm just like,
it's the ultimate irony where he seems like the safest pick for the Warriors is this guy who has played one competitive college basketball game. And nobody really knows one way or the other. He seems safe and anything else seems like a dramatic risk for them to take should they keep their pick position.
Right. And for the Warriors specifically, I think that they need to make an internal calculation upon what they're trying to accomplish with this pick. Because if they're trying to select a player here that will retain trade value going forward into the future. Yeah. Or Anthony Edwards. Like we know that in today's NBA, centers are almost like, you know, cars that come off the lot, right? They're going to have something of a depreciating value in trade markets because everyone has a center already for the most part, or at least you can't build the trade market that you want to for a center because a lot of teams have them.
Yeah.
So if they're trying to make a pick to retain trade value to, you know, maybe attach with the Timberwolves pick and move on for a Bradley Beal deal at the trade deadline or next offseason, I don't think that I take James Wiseman because I'd be worried about the center position. If they're trying to help themselves now, like I'd be taking James Wiseman because I think James Wiseman's good.
Well, but your expectation, I think, would be that Anthony Edwards would probably be off the board by then, that the Wolves go Edwards. Is that your expectation if you had to make a guess about it?
I mean, look, I have to do a mock draft for Monday, and I don't feel any level of confidence in what the Wolves are going to do right now. I've heard too many different things. Put the proverbial gun to my head right now and made me make a pick, I think I would say LaMelo, but
that
I don't feel
interesting.
Like, I don't feel great about it though. I really just don't, I don't know what they're going to do yet because I was told, you know, a month ago or whatever, they've done due diligence into James Wiseman. They're like, he's at least being looked at. They've certainly done due diligence into Anthony Edwards. They've had a meeting with LaMelo Ball at this stage. Like, and on top of that, they want to trade the pick. So like, I don't even know who's going to have the number one overall pick. And when you talk to sources around the league, you talk to agents, you talk to executives, there's just a real sense of uncertainty about what's going to happen because there's a sense of uncertainty upon who is going to have the number one and number two overall picks.
And there are these hidden factors where, okay, let's hypothetically say that the Hornets make a trade to the top pick to get Wiseman, as rumors have floated about. If you are Excel, do you start sandbagging? Do you start saying, as has happened with draft picks in the past, hell no. You know, we're going to come up with some tendonitis unless you back away. Don't make that trade. He's going to the Warriors. We're not having him go to the Hornets. I mean, I'm not saying that would happen. I'm not saying that's in the offing, but that type of thing can happen to confound some of the scenarios we were discussing, because it is unusual for a team like the Warriors to have the number two pick.
Yeah, no question. You know, I've heard some of that already, like, you know, more speculative than reporting. So do not aggregate this, aggregators.
We are speculating of what might happen.
Yes. Like one person posed to me who was not involved in this situation, like, hey, will Karl Anthony Towns and CAA be particularly happy if the Timberwolves take James Wiseman, who is rep by Excel and could theoretically be his replacement down the road. Like, I don't know that I'd be particularly happy if I was Karl Anthony Towns in that situation.
Yeah, they did not draw the best straw for this number one pick. The Timberwolves didn't. I think you would rather have the number two pick. You want somebody else to make that first decision in this draft. This is a very intimidating draft to be the first team to pick. And for them, they just have, they've got their guys in both spots, which seem to overlap with, you know, if you're them, you would far rather that you had the number one pick in next year's draft. Well, anybody would, but them especially.
Well, the funniest part of it in that vein is that, like, on one hand, I totally agree with you, but then on the other hand, because the Warriors are at two and they're exploring other trade avenues, like, the Timberwolves hold the cards as well, and you'd almost certainly rather be at one than you would be at two, because everyone would rather trade for one in order to get the certainty, because, as I've written previously, Warriors are throwing smoke everywhere in every direction.
But if I was a cowardly GM, I would far prefer to have the second pick than the first pick in an uncertain draft, just because of the stigma attached to bust potential, that we forget about number two picks that don't work out a lot of the time. We just is like, oh yeah, whatever, versus a Greg Oden or an Anthony Bennett, where those names tend to echo. But by the way, I'm not entirely certain that the Warriors are just throwing smoke everywhere on what they're doing. That's as much as I'll say about it. It's interesting. It's you know, for instance, I think I wrote about the workouts with Denny, and there's this assumption people have that that's coming from the Warriors, but it actually didn't. So it's interesting to see what people think and where people think things are coming from. At this point of year, because we're going to be hearing a lot of different things. There is going to be a lot of smoke, and yeah, I'm just wondering. So, we don't want to overlap with your mock. Can you sell me on Anthony Edwards though? That's not a pick I necessarily feel great about if I'm the Wolves and I'm taking Edwards. I have my reasons. I'm not writing off the idea that he could become some superstar. I'm not writing off the idea that he has incredible talent, but it just seems like he didn't do anything particularly well in that one season of college ball. You know, he got fouled a little bit, maybe averaged 5 free throws. Maybe you could say he did that, but there wasn't anything he did tangibly great. Is that unfair to say?
So yeah, let's, maybe I'll give the positive spin and you can give the negative, like where you're at after. With Edwards, the idea that teams have is, A, he's just an utterly elite athlete. Like, his intersection of power and explosiveness will be in the top 5% of all NBA players from day one. He's just that kind of monster athletically, right? He also pairs it with a real fluidity and body control for creating shots. And the ability to create pull-up jumpers in the way from anywhere on the floor that he can. Like, literally any angle, any situation, you give it to him in ISO, you give it to him in a ball screen, you give it to him in the mid-post, you give it to him out on the break. Like, any situation you put him in, he can create a reasonable look. at the basket. The problem is he just can't make them right now. But if you trust him to continue and you trust this elite level athlete with elite level body control to continue to rep through the jumper, the ceiling is very, very high with someone that can be just like a hyper elite shot creator who can get his shot at genuinely any point. Teams look at the defensive tools as well and see upside. Like if you watch the last 5 minutes of the SMU game last year, they're like, oh, wow, this guy can really sit down and defend when he wants to. That part of it, I don't really buy because I think that he just doesn't want to defend at the end of the day. And we have no evidence of him wanting to defend at any level he's played at. But the offensive stuff I do get, because being able to create your own shot is arguably the most important thing in today's NBA. And he can do that. It just comes down to whether or not he's willing to A, utilize his tools to drive forward toward the basket versus settling for the step back constantly. He has like a Dion Waiters-y syndrome there. And whether or not he can improve as a jump shooter, because he's going to have to improve the jump shot efficiency to do that.
Can you give me an optimistic comp for him if I'm trying to get excited?
If you're trying to get excited, I think the optimistic comp is like more explosive Bradley Beal this year that we saw. So like didn't make the All-NBA team because didn't really defend, chose not to defend this year.
That's not what I heard from his wife on Twitter. It was a grand conspiracy. But yes, you were saying.
Yeah, just I mean, I don't even know that his wife like defended the fact that he didn't play defense. I think that she was just mad that he didn't make it after averaging 30 a night.
Yeah, that's the funny part. That was the crux of the argument. We should all be so lucky to get so much support. But yes, you were saying.
Yeah. Like a guy that's going to create his own shot at a high level, hopefully becomes an elite level, not an elite level shooter, but like a well above average shooter and can average 25 plus a night while being questionable in terms of effort level defensively.
Yeah, I could see all that playing out. I think the counter argument, succinctly put, would be didn't guard, didn't shoot it, didn't pass. Am I missing anything there?
No, those are all accurate. let's be very clear here. Those things are all accurate. And if I had a top three pick in this draft, I would be moving down. Someone that both of us know, because we both talked to him together at the G League Showcase, brought up and works for an NBA team, brought up the idea if he had a pick at number one or number two, he would be undertaking the strategy of just trying to marginally trade down multiple times in the draft. Yeah. So like if you're Minnesota, go from one to three, pick up a small asset. Like maybe you get like a lottery protected first round pick from Charlotte or something. Go from three to four because Chicago would want to guarantee themselves LaMelo Ball and pick up like a couple of second rounders. Go from four to seven because Detroit wants to guarantee themselves someone. Go from seven to nine and then just like continue to pick up assets that way. Just little ones, small ones, because the difference between the prospects this year and the certainty between the prospects this year is just not there. Like there's nothing that makes me feel confident about projecting a lot of these guys.
Yeah, I think that's a sound strategy. I am more in the grin and bear it, you know, grit your teeth, make the pick if you've got one of those high draft picks, just because it just seems so hard to find a market. Maybe I'm reading that wrong, but I don't see teams really wanting to move up like they would in a normal draft. And I don't know. Wiseman, here's the thing. This is now an emotional, subjective read on things. If I'm looking at it again from the Warriors land perspective, I get excited about Wiseman. Yeah, you know, I don't know if that's a pick I would make if I were them, if I had all their resources, but it's exciting to think about. And if it's a bad pick, it seems like people wouldn't kill him for it. And so that seems like it makes a certain logical amount of sense. And I just wonder if teams are just going to go for what politically makes the most sense, that there's going to be less risk-taking in a situation like this.
Yeah, risk aversion is a very real thing, especially at the top of drafts. Guys don't want to get fired, right? Like nobody wants to get fired in the NBA. I will say this, like once you get past those like top three, four, five spots, there are some teams that are trying to like move up. Mm. Like there is some interest in like trying to get a shot at taking Onyeka Okongwu if he slips to number 7 or so. There are some teams that are interested in like, you know, does Kyra Lewis go somewhere like that? Like there are teams that are interested like from 12, 13, 14, 15, you know, 17, 18, like trying to move up a little
bit. I like these guys like Okongwu where you wonder how much in terms of draft selection boost will Bam have given him in the end? Because it won't be nothing, right? It won't be nothing. He will be drafted at least one position higher, if not more, than he would have been if not for the career arc of Bam Adebayo. Like that's just how it works. People find a prototype, especially one of these guys where they don't exactly fit a particular mold. And if they're successful at the NBA level, remember for years it was, let's find the next Draymond Green. It has this ripple effect where the guys kind of, and I'm not saying that should warn teams against taking Okongwu. I'm just saying that kind of thing happens where a prospect drafts off the success of a similar style of player.
Yeah, and Bam is one of those guys this year. The other guy that's driving that is Duncan Robinson. Everyone in the mid second round and down is trying to find like the undervalued shooter who can be a specialist, like Jordan Wara, Justinian Jessup, I'm trying to think of like a couple others off the top of my head. Isaiah Joe is another one.
Is that Sam Merrill's music?
Sam Merrill is another one for sure. Like teams in the second round are like, hey, we're trying to find these dudes.
How old is Sam Merrill? Is he 36, 37? I don't know. I he's the guy I'm rooting for. I would enjoy Sam Merrill really popping. He was one of the most fun college players to watch. I will tell you,
I have Sam Merrill at 36, 37.
Okay.
Something like that. But I've always been a fan of Sam Merrill. Sam Merrill was the first player on the Game Theory podcast this year because he's just the greatest human. Shout out Sam Merrill.
Yeah, shout out Sam Merrill. Yeah, he's there are athleticism questions there, but he's very skilled. He can shoot the hell out of the ball. But no, not a guy for the conversation we're having about the top 10. So when it comes to this momentum and who has gone up and who has gone down, here was my read on the situation as a guy who enjoys watching Killian Hayes. I felt like he was getting some real momentum in those games in Germany. People were tuning in. People were watching them. He was making things happen. And then it seems like he sort of slipped from the consciousness during the pandemic paralysis, and he almost is less so. Is that a wrong read on the situation? Where are people at on Killian Hayes?
I would say that based off of my conversations with teams, the internet has always been much higher on Killian Hayes than the NBA is.
Yeah.
That's not to say that he's not a good player, because I think he is a good player. Like, I have him in my top 10. Like, I'm relatively enthused by Killian Hayes. But the NBA has never really thought of him as like this, like, you know, and I love Kevin O'Connor. I certainly don't mean to take shots here. He's genuinely one of like the nicest human beings I think I've ever met in my life.
He is. Sam Merrill.
Yeah. Like Sam Merrill level, great person. Like Kevin has him at number one. And I've personally yet to talk to anyone in the NBA that would have him like in the top three, I would say. Again, not to say that Kevin is wrong and everyone across the league is right, but you know, most teams that I've talked to really worry about the fact that Killian Hayes doesn't do anything with his right hand. I watched every single assist that Killian Hayes had this year.
He does the weird, also on the finishes, the kind of weird Ben Simmons look where it's using the wrong hand on the. Yeah, that definitely happens. I think that's a concern. I think the athleticism is something that teams have been concerned about. I also wouldn't be shocked if he is way better than the conventional wisdom, just because the feel for the game, the skill level, and I guess the rumors are that he's working on that right hand. But yeah, I think that's one of those internet wisdom versus NBA conventional wisdom battles is going to be Killian Hayes.
I think Hayes is definitely one. Like you mentioned, like the feel for the game is why I have him as high as I do. Like I have him in the top 10. Like I think he's a really, really great player, and I think he's going to make an impact in the NBA. And if he hits and the step back jumper is real and he figures out how to make an impact off the catch as a shooter, yeah, like he very well might be like slightly worse D'Angelo Russell, like something like that. But I don't know. Maybe slightly worse offensively, much better defensively. D'Angelo Russell's the better way to put it.
Yeah, he actually guarded. He did a pretty good job. Pretty good job on that. I mean, that's the model there. If we're doing the comps, if we're just running down the list, I think of James Wiseman, optimistic comp. Maybe you got like a little Chris Bosch there. I mean, we were just trying to work on those comps and Warriors plus minus, but Wiseman, Chris Bosch, Edwards. I'm even trying to remember your Edwards comp. God, what was it? What was your Edwards comp?
I said like athletic Bradley Beal this
athletic,
year.
Athletic Bradley Beal, Avdija. I don't know. But yeah, D'Angelo Russell is the one that you hear for Killian Hayes. And I'm more of a Hayes optimist. But look, if it doesn't go well for me and I'm humiliated and he's the French Cameron Payne, I can always just chalk it up to a truncated season. That's how I'll cowardly do it.
Right. This is how we do it. Yeah. And then the other guy is Paul Reed. The internet has like a very real fixation. And it's not even just the internet too. Like, I know that both Kevin Pelton and John Hollinger really like Paul Reed.
I love Paul
Reed. And anytime that like Pelton and Hollinger and then you as well like a guy, I'm just like, okay, maybe I need to go back and like really watch and see. So I actually did that two nights ago and I was like, okay, Paul Reed, I get it. I think he's going to drive whoever his first coach is going to get driven crazy by Paul Reed.
Interesting. Why do you think?
Because the athleticism and the body control and the twitch, like the reactivity, everything that he does defensively to make plays, like get steals and blocks, and like he's a riverboat gambler.
Yeah.
It looks great on the stat sheet, and it helped DePaul in a very tangible way. DePaul was, I believe, 6 points better than the opposition when he was on the court.
I heard that on the Game Theory podcast, that exact stat.
Yeah, and 21 points worse than the opposition when he was off the court.
Yeah.
So he's very clearly effective, but I mean, he's like wild and all over the place right now too. Like he is flying, trying to get these weak side blocks and taking himself out of position. Like he's the king of the flyby on the closeout because he tries to block jump shots all the time. A bit foul prone on the perimeter because he tries to like swallow guys up. DePaul also played this fucking terrible like hard hedge scheme where they basically put him in situations to get fouled because they tried to utilize his athleticism well. And then he had to like sprint back in recovery and they basically lived in scramble situations the entire possession because they took him so far out of position with this defensive like scheme that they ran. So like, I think that there are situational reasons why you should be excited about Paul Reed. They revolve around defensive twitch, defensive production, really great body control around the basket, can actually drive and finish, you know, off of one or two dribbles, and is long enough to get to the basket off of one or two dribbles. I just really worry that like it's kind of like a Christian Wood deal maybe where the first team that gets Paul Reed is not going to have the most success with Paul Reed. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. And I don't know, man, it's just so crazy. I'm trying to think about the last time I saw a Paul Reed game, and it was eons ago. And then there's this weird question of what have these guys turned into since everything stopped? You know, have they been killing it in the gym? Have they been working on their bodies like James Wiseman seems to have been doing, or have they just completely fallen apart and they're eating Twinkies and they've just learned that maybe in the grand scheme, basketball is not that important and everything else has been put into stark relief? I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, these are big unanswered questions. And God, it's just a nightmare scenario. Can you give us a little bit of a preview, since I don't think everybody knows the juxtaposition between this draft and the next draft and what people are expecting from that next draft? Because, you know, you look at the Warriors having a pick of the Wolves, top three protected, so it will not be Cade Cunningham. But you almost wonder, what is the number one pick value stacked up against pick what in 2021? Like, is the fifth pick in 2021 right now a higher value than number one in 2020?
Yes, for me.
Yeah.
Maybe go down as far as like seven. Damn. Like, I think that all of Cade Cunningham, Jalen Green, BJ Boston, Jonathan Kuminga, Evan Mobley, Usman Garuba, at the very least, that's six. I really like Scotty Barnes. I don't know that he would necessarily be that guy. Zaire Williams is like a crazy open court athlete who can do a lot of different stuff. I've heard really good things out of Kentucky about Terrence Clark as well. It's given what this year looks like, I think that the number is like 5 to 7, depending on what you think of some of these players coming into high school.
Yeah. It's especially with how wingless it is this year versus 2021, which just seems to be an embarrassment of riches on that front. So yeah, that's the other thing that's a little interesting to track. And for the Warriors, it factors into their decisions. That Wolves pick, what do you do with it? Is it the apple of everybody's eye right now because they're so disappointed in what the 2020 draft is that it might even be smart to trade right now versus exposing some of those picks that people value so much in 2021 eventually, and then the bloom comes off the rose? I don't know, but we will have you back to talk about it when the time comes. Sam, thanks so much for stopping by and informing us. I wish you the best with this draft and really congratulate you on when it is over and you can finally move on with your life and look at the next draft. That's what I'm congratulating you on.
Well, and I get to move on basically immediately because the college basketball season starts on November 25th.
It's completely, completely, completely insane. Okay. Thanks so much, Sam. Thanks to all of you listening. We will be back with more draft content, free agency content, and eventually, pretty soon, actually, NBA season content. So stay safe, everybody. Happy holidays.